For KOSU News, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Governor Fallon marks the halfway point in her administration with her second inaugural speech on Monday. First off, Neva, what did you think of the speech?
Well, no surprises. I think it's like most inaugural speeches. You start off by recounting what you believe your successes have been in your first term and then looking forward. And she outlined her 3 points that we've heard over and over again, I think, since that address. And that was education, over-incarceration, and health issues. And that's certainly biting off a chunk to say that those are going to be where you're going to focus your attention, because those are, you can't find any more hot button issues that the legislature is going to touch than in those areas. So I think it will be interesting to see in her State of the State how she really moves forward in advancing specifics that she wants to see, and whether or not she can build a consensus with a supermajority of fellow Republicans where leadership will be the mark of whether you're successful or not.
Ryan, so, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, I don't think that it's any surprise. I've been a critic of Governor Fallon's first 4 years in office, but you know, I think that we should withhold judgment on these next 4 years. This is really an opportunity for Governor Fallon to decide whether the campaign is over. Is she running for any higher office? Is she posturing or positioning herself for an appointment in a cabinet and some Republican administration in the future? Or is this it? Because, you know, she has an opportunity. This is her Henry Bellman moment. And in particular on issues like criminal justice reform and health care, Neva's exactly right. It really comes down to leadership. If she is on the script, if she's sticking to talking points, if she's taking this very politically safe route, or the perceived politically safe route on those issues, we're not going to get very far. And I think that her administration's legacy will reflect that. However, if she really steps up to the plate on criminal justice issues, on health care, and addresses the 500,000 Oklahomans that don't have health insurance and our prison systems that are busting at the seams, and why people are there to begin with, she could be one of Oklahoma's great governors.
There wasn't many specifics, but that's not unusual for an inaugural speech. But there also wasn't any pie in the sky, ask not what your country can do for you. Was that missing in this?
I don't know that it was missing. I mean, every politician or political leader has kind of their own style. This was pretty much, I think, Mary Fallon's style of kind of expressing her sentiments to Oklahomans. But I think Ryan is right. I think it really kind of potentially throws down the gauntlet to an opportunity to really be bold and courageous and get into the weeds of these issues that have to be addressed. And I think the governor that steps to the plate and provides that leadership will have a legacy, and it is something I think Oklahomans are looking forward to seeing. And so it will be an interesting beginning of the session to see where the specifics really come down.
I think this session we'll know pretty, we'll have a very clear picture of whether the next 4 years we're going to have a candidate or a governor.
All other statewide elected officers took their oaths of office on Monday, including the winner of the most watched race of 2014, State Superintendent Joy Hoffmeister. Ryan, what do you think of her taking the reins of the Department of Education after controversial figure Janet Barisi?
I'll add my voice to the many others that are already out there saying that she has got her work cut out for her. Not only is she taking over for an administration that was widely viewed as very divisive and counterproductive to the cause of education. And there's a lot of bridges that need repaired between the State Department of Education, educators, parents, and students. And I think that she's up to that job. But she also has the task of increasing teacher pay. She has the task of reforming our testing system that's really driving our system towards failure. And that's going to require the political will in the legislature. And I think that like Governor Fallon, Joy Hoffmeister has this opportunity to be a leader and lead the legislature. If the legislature is leading her, then we're not going to get there.
I'm sure all eyes will be on the first meeting of the month, which will be coming at the end of January, which 4 years ago was a pretty controversial one with the whole dictatorship and all that kind of things. Do you think people are going to be watching this meeting and seeing what Joy does?
I think they will, and they will continue to watch, because Ryan is right. Education is the number one issue that we always hear. It is the thing that the voters, that the citizens of Oklahoma know is broken. They want fixed. And Joy Hoffmeister coming in as the 14th superintendent has a very daunting task. Anyone would, because you're right. I mean, we have miserable statistics reflecting our education system. It's broken. It gets a lot of money, and yet everyone says it needs more, and no one disputes the fact that that we want to see teacher pay increase, we want to see more money to the classroom, and all of the normal political rhetoric that really does have some reality behind it. But it's, I think Ryan is right. If the legislature decides that they are going to become the junior superintendents of public instruction, then we have a bigger mess than we ever thought during the last 4 years.
Yeah, and then, you know, whether it was Janet Borisi or Joy Hoffmeister, if the legislature is driving the train on education, neither of them I think Hoffmeister is probably a better diplomat
Anytime you're charting a new course, you're trying to make change, which mm-hmm. Janet Borisi unapologetically fought for big, bold ideas during her 4 years in office. It became very divisive, you're right. And the legislature, there was a piling on at the end. And I think to kind of let all of that dust settle, it's going to be interesting to see Joy Hoffmeister's also going to have to step up to the plate like Governor Fallon and provide leadership, not just expect that others are going to kind of point the direction.
I think, you know, an early instance of that with Superintendent Hoffmeister is how is she going to react to those last minute hires that Janet Borisi made in the position where I think that she added, you know, millions of dollars to the payroll by hiring additional staffers
will be interesting to see. I think there's those last-minute stories and those last-minute comments that were made. I would like to see really the bottom line. I'd like to see it on paper in black and white, what really transpired and whether it was all that was alluded or said it was in the closing stretch.
Right.
A Pottawatomie County District Judge makes a ruling which could have a major impact on the 2013 GOP workers' comp overhaul bill. The judge finds a Hibden Tire employee can, in fact, sue the company for negligence despite the two-year-old law. Neva, what do you think of this ruling?
Well, I mean, I think the workers' comp attorney, Bob Burke, who is representing this worker against the tire company, he basically said that it was a monumental ruling that challenges the entire foundation of the workers' comp system, and I think he's right. I mean, you talk about kind of blowing this thing totally out of the water, leaving everybody standing back trying to figure out really what the ramifications are. And, you know, I think it goes back to this continued debate about the, in the words of many of the workers' comp attorneys who felt like it was a sloppy drafted law, and now they have continued to delve into constitutional questions related to it. But the big question is, do the wheels come off of workers' comp and this movement from the one system to the other? I mean, it kind of raises a total unlimited number of questions that I think the legislature now is going to be back on their plate to address.
Ryan, this doesn't necessarily call the law unconstitutional. It just simply says it's ineffectual. It doesn't matter what the law says, it's going to court.
Absolutely. And it reminds us of why we have a workers' compensation system to begin with. I mean, over 100 years ago, there was this bargain that was created to protect employees and employers. It protects employers from going to a jury, getting verdicts against them, the unpredictability of being sued in district court. And it protects employees because it says, well, you can't sue your employer in district court for all but a handful of issues or a handful of instances, you will be taken care of. And if you're killed in the line of employment, your family will be taken care of. And it's this bargain between the employer and the employee. And I think that oftentimes whenever the workers' compensation system has been politically attacked over the last decade plus, I think that it forgets that history, that there is a bargain there. And if we take that system away, our default is what exactly happened right here, is to go to district court. And I don't think that that's a solution for employers or employees.
It's not a solution, but I don't think anyone has ever said that there's not the need for the workers' comp system. I think it's always been a philosophical and a political debate over which is the best system and which is the most effective system, both for employers and employees. But, I mean, when you have a system now and you have a basically kind of a change in attitude that that in what one of the things that Bob Burke said was that Foreseeable means that an accident is anything that is reasonably predictable. Well, under that guise, I mean, you can look at 98%, I think, is what they say, all accidental injuries probably fall in that category. And, I mean, it just opens up, again, what it opens up is just a field day for attorneys. And I don't think the folks paying, you know, on either side of the ledger, the employees or the employers, are going to be the beneficiaries at the end of the day.
You know, in that balance that was struck over 100 years ago, the employees gave up something. The employees gave up the right to sue their employer in district court for some degree of certainty of protecting them and their damages and being compensated if they're injured. And employers received the benefit of a predictable system. Over the years, and especially in the last decade or so, all of the reforms have really been on one side of that equation. They have taken away rights of the employees, and they have increased the bargaining position of the employer, and in particular, their big insurance companies.
And I think that would be arguable based on whether you're a workers' comp lawyer or whether you're whether you're the chamber type or the business employer, you know, paying those premiums. So I mean, I think it's in the eye of the beholder somewhat. They've just again. It's a messed up deal, kind of like education we talked about. They've got to come back to the table and fix it, but everyone just continuing to go to court to try to get that accomplished is not going to get anything done well for, I think, the folks that really do need, I mean, they do need to have an expectation that they are going to be taken care of and have their day in court.
The State Board of Health is considering a plan to use Medicaid expansion money to help low-income Oklahomans who don't have health insurance. The plan is coming from the Oklahoma Hospital Association. Ryan, do you give this any hope in Oklahoma?
You know, again, I think that it comes back to what kind of leadership is Governor Fallon willing to stand on at the beginning of her term. We've got over 500,000 Oklahomans that are uninsured, 150,000 plus that would be covered if we expanded Medicaid. You know, somewhere around that number, I think, with the Hospital Association's plan here to expand Insure Oklahoma rather than just expanding Medicaid across the board. It's got to happen. And not, you know, and I've talked about, you know, the Oklahomans that if you get sick or injured and you're facing bankruptcy or the inability to go to the doctor and have it compensated. Let's look at the Hospital Association's take here. They're looking at uncompensated care, and in particular in rural hospitals, you know, the folks that are showing up can't afford to pay in an emergency room, you know, they've got to treat them. And they have this uncompensated care, and I think it's over 10% of their expenditures each year. That is devastating to these rural hospitals. If we don't do something soon, I would not be surprised if we're in a situation where rural hospitals are closing their doors.
And even this does not expand Medicaid, literally, but it does take Medicaid expansion money, which is also kind of a sticky wicket there. Where do you think Oklahoma's going to end up being on this one?
Well, I don't know that we have any idea at this point. I think Ryan is right. When you have $550 million being paid out because you have uninsured Oklahomans having to go to primarily rural hospitals, I mean, it's unsustainable. I mean, they've been over and over, year in and year out, coming to the legislature, the Hospital Association, saying something has to give. We cannot continue to bear the brunt of this. But those 600,000 Oklahoma adults who are uninsured, based on, you know, the statistics that they typically throw out, I mean, something has to be done. I think the question is, again, it's a legislative focus that has to come down to, are we going to just continue to make it politically charged rhetoric, or are we going to do something about it? And it's going to be a situation of having to bite the bullet. I mean, there's political consequences to having to deal with these big issues. And if all these folks are interested in is getting reelected in 2 years or 4 years, nothing's going to happen. So I hope these issues are big enough and dominant enough that we really will step up to the plate and see some real results.
Yeah, these legislators that have been able to run around the Capitol and say that they're rejecting Obamacare, that they're against President Obama's socialized medicine and all of this stuff, right? The consequences in their district, I think, have been difficult to quantify. But if you live in a district and you're one of those legislators and you have a hospital that has to close, and the reason it's closing is because of the increased amount of uncompensated care expenditures they're having to make, and there's a solution on the table, and you didn't take it, and your only reason is because Obama?
Well,
but, I don't think that that flies anymore.
But I think the added kind of fly in the ointment is that you cannot continue to take these federal dollars, you know, on the short term fix, and knowing that the state at some point down the road is going to have the full, you know, the full bullet. They're going to have to fully fund that with no federal aid. So I think that's where the real rub comes, and I think that's where they've got to come to a solution of just not let's take the money and get a quick fix. Let's figure out something that we can deal with when we're already talking about, you know, standstill budgets or even something more in terms of a budget shortfall.
And that is definitely
but you know, expanding Medicaid, though, the increased savings increased savings and increased revenue outweigh the state's cost over the long term.
Yeah, that's both sides of the issue right there. Yeah. So thank you very much. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.